I think kids can handle some pretty complex flavors, and I like to give them the opportunity to make those decisions on their own instead of me determining what was a kid food and what was an adult food. Don't think of your cilantro, your basil, your parsley as like an afterthought. Like, it can be the main attraction. You can go really big with these things. It's not selfish to desire to care for yourself. In fact, it's your responsibility. You get one body, you get one life, and no one says that you're supposed to give it all away.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. So friends, are you ready to join me? Let's do this. Hey friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii, not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, I cannot recommend enough Dr. Erica Siegel's two-part collection, The Nourish Me Kitchen. It is one of the most stunning books I have ever come across, and like I talk about in this episode, I think it can help so many people, and it also makes incredible gifts. You'll understand a little bit why after listening to our beautiful conversation. We talk about all things healthy and delicious food recipes that you can easily make at home, tips and tricks to feeding your children, including dealing with picky eaters, coffee and wine as medicinal drinks, and then so many other things beyond food. Things like the importance of breast massage and how to do that at home, whether or not you actually need to wear a bra, why you should declutter for stress, how you can support healthy dopamine production in your daily life, the benefits of wearing comfortable clothing, how and why you should ask for help, and so much more. Definitely take advantage of Erica's offer to get 10% off this incredible book. You can get it on Amazon. Again, it is the Nourish Me Kitchen, and you can use the coupon code MELAVALON, that's MELAVALON, on Amazon to get 10% off. Again, use the coupon code MELAVALON on Amazon to get 10% off the Nourish Me Kitchen, which, by the way, does have a foreword by the incredible Dr. Zach Bush. Erica is also offering my audience a free PDF, 14 Steps to Take Good Care. Definitely check that out. You can get that for free at melanieavalon.com/goodcare. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/nourishkitchen. Those show notes will have a full transcript as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. I can't wait to hear what you guys think. Definitely let me know in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, I think that's all the things. As a brief reminder, you can get 10% off the Nourish Me Kitchen. Cannot recommend enough getting this book for yourself and your loved ones with the coupon code MELAVALON on Amazon. And you can get Erica's free guide, 14 Steps to Take Good Care, at melanieavalon.com/goodcare. And now, without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Dr. Erica Siegel. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I'm about to have. It is a long time coming. And so the backstory on today's conversation, I first went to the Eudaimonia conference. I went both years that it's happened. The first year that it started, which now I don't even know which year that was, but regardless, I'm pretty sure it was at the dinner after party of the first night. Actually, it was an event put on by the founders. That's where we met, right? At that house party?
We did.
So that's where I met this fabulous character, Dr. Erica Siegel. What's really funny about this, so she has, and friends, I cannot even express the beauty captured in this book, well, books. So it is this, it's called The Nourish Me Kitchen. It is a 2-volume set. So the first set is Essential Health Wisdom. The second set is Wholesome Everyday Recipes. And the foreword is by Dr. Zach Bush, who has actually also been on this show. So I will put a link to that in the show notes. Or was he on my other show? Regardless, I've interviewed him before, so I'll put that in the show notes. So I'm just laughing, remembering, because it's, well, first of all, it's stunning. It's hundreds of pages, so much wisdom. So the first volume is It goes over everything related to health you could ever, ever think of. So it's not just diet. I know it's the Nourish Me Kitchen, but it's not just diet. It's about mindset and exercise and, you know, sauna therapy and contrast therapy and literally anything you could ever think of to uplift your life is covered in this book. And she even says in the very beginning to use it as, you know, use it the way it serves you. So like as a reference, if you want to go and search for something specific, or you can read it back to cover, like whatever it may be, it's a resource for you. And then the second volume is all of these fabulous, stunning recipes. But there's so much content. It's so heavy. And I remember Dr. Siegel gave it to me and was like, are you okay to like carry this around the rest of the night? I was like, yeah, like, how big can it be? And then I'm going to pick it up in right now.
10 pounds, the two books together.
And then I remember I was in my like, you know, little black cocktail dress and high heels. And I was like lugging it around the rest of the night. I was like, whoa, I definitely am getting my...
You were such a trooper. Yeah, you were such a trooper. Most people are like, can you mail that to me? Which I'm also happy to do. But you were like, no, I'm taking it home. I've got this. And I appreciated that.
I just remember carrying it and like being like, I'm getting my muscle, my workout in right now. So in any case, fast forward, here we are today. And I did read it, Dr. Siegel. I did read it, Erica, front to cover, like every single word. I mean, no, this is amazing. Your book is, I can't even imagine. How long did this take? There's just so much in there.
Yeah. Well, the book set, it took me 15 years because I was doing it bit by bit and learning as I went, because I had my full-time practice and raising two kids. And then I would just have like an epiphany. Oh, I need to write about this. Oh, I need to include that. And then I realized, oh gosh, this wants to be a comprehensive functional medicine guide. I got to go really deep. And so it really took 15 years from my first idea of it being a really robust cookbook and health guide to being the project that it became. And it was, you know, it was a collaborative effort. I had amazing designers and photographer editors. So I could not have done this alone. You know, any beautiful big project requires, I think, multiple minds on it. And yeah, it took a lot longer than I had hoped, but I am so very happy with it. And I think it just landed exactly when it needed to for me in my life and for the people that pick it up. Everything takes its due time. I feel good about it.
As you should. It's literally amazing. Wait, so did you take, no, actually, so you talk about it in the gratitude. You worked with different photographers, right, for it?
I worked mostly with one photographer, my dear friend Lottie, who was our nanny for 5 years. And she just had, you know, a beautiful camera and a great eye. And I had her start taking photos of food that we would make or things that we were doing with the kids. And we just started to compile these beautiful photos over time. And then some of them are actually just from my iPhone, or my son would take them. So it was a little bit of a, you know, pull it together project. It wasn't very formal in that way, but the photos came out beautifully because Lottie Wood is a beautiful photographer, and food and nature are just beautiful to me. The colors and the textures of those things, they don't really require very much.
That is so true. Oh my goodness. Okay. It was the editors. I think you had different, like a different editor for each book.
Multiple editors. Yes. So many editors. And then eventually when it was coming into full form, then I hired real pros. I had an editor from, or two editors from Food and Wine magazine that edited all the recipes just to make sure that they were consistent and clear and easy to follow. And then I had a dear friend, Natasha Pettit, who did the first book editing.
Awesome. 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 Well, I will say, so one of my habits with this show is, so I do all my prep for like a couple months. And then the night before, I just go on Amazon and I read all the reviews, because it gives me like a perspective from like what is resonating with other people. Well, first of all, you have every single review is like 5 stars, I'm pretty sure. So many people, and I agree, so many people were like talking about how it's amazing for them, but also how it's like the perfect gift. And I was like, this is so true. 10 pounds aside, like anybody, like if you need a gift for like, because it can be hard to like find gifts that are like applicable to everybody. This is literally applicable to everybody, and it's stunning. So friends, get it for yourself, get it for everybody else that you know, stock up now for gifts. And actually, I'll go ahead and give listeners, so if you're getting on Amazon, the code Mel Avalon, so MelAvalon, will get you 10% off. So definitely use that. One, I'm really curious, 15 years, that's a long time. Did anything drastically change, like opinion-wise, from the beginning of that to the end? I know you said like you had evolving, like fish oil, for example. I know you said you changed your mind on a bit. Like, were there some things that changed in your perspective?
I love that question because we really want to know if health information is evergreen or if it's a fad, right? And, you know, we're always being bombarded with this is the new science and new information. And then it's hard because, well, what are we doing with the information last year that contradicts this? And so while I would write a chapter and then I would revisit it in a year, in 2 years, in 5 years. And then at the end, like, okay, I wrote this now 10 years ago. Is it still applicable? And the really interesting thing is that most of it was completely applicable. There may have been more research to support it, but there were very few things that I said, you know, I want to do a 180 on this. And I think it's because the foundations of health remain the same, because this isn't really about biohacking and it's not really about a new peptide or anything like that. It's about foundational care, and the foundational requirements like hydration, movement, good food, and community, good sleep, those don't change. They really don't change. And sure, we always get neat new information to update our techniques to do those things more efficiently, or we may have better understanding of why those things are important. But you know, treating a human being and taking care of this body, it really is the same now as it was hundreds of years ago. Sure, we have to manage and mitigate more toxins, and the world is not the same place, but our bodies are very much so quite similar. And I just find that health information can be evergreen if it's not radical. And I don't write about radical things in my books. There were a few pieces that I've given more thought on, and I think I would revise my section on intermittent fasting. I would bring a little more nuance there and talk more about how it's not always perfect for women or women that are premenstrual or perimenopausal. I would give a little bit more context there so people felt seen in those pages where it might not resonate with them to skip breakfast. It might be better to eat breakfast and have an earlier dinner, that sort of thing. But for the most part, when I read back things I wrote 10 years ago, I thought, wow, this is good. It's still really, really good. I feel good about printing this, publishing this. And I'm sure that some of those things will age differently and I might feel differently. But for the most part, they're just kind of standard staple foundational health tips.
That's amazing. And actually, to that point, it definitely felt timeless. Like, I couldn't tell that, you know, it was written at different points in time. Like, it all just flows very seamlessly. Actually, the thing that's coming to my mind is like a good example, I think, of this. You're talking about, you know, it's not, you know, biohacking per se. It's just the foundations of health supporting things. Like one of the very first sections of the first volume talks about the importance of hydration. And you point out that like aging really has to do a lot with like hydration, like, you know, like drying up. And like, that's such a basic concept, but nobody really talks about that. And like in the anti-aging, you know, longevity biohacking sphere, I was like, you know, but that's really true. like we got to start with the really basics here.
Really basics. Yeah. Before we start stacking all these cool new techniques, like how is your water getting in? Is it charged enough to get into your cells, and is your body clean enough to be able to take it in and utilize it? It's pretty fascinating to break things down to the foundations and realize that that's actually what it's usually about.
And I love, so you say, first I'll tell you really quickly, one of the sections is this overwhelming in a good way. It actually really reminds me of Healing with Whole Foods. Is that TCM?
Yes.
I used to like read it because it's kind of like a similar to yours, like an encyclopedia of all these different foods. And I would reference it to like see like what different foods were doing. And so you have a similar section where you go through, I mean, every food you could think of and
the pantry. Yep.
Yes. The benefits of them. And I was curious to see which ones that so a few different questions here. I like seeing the ones that we have overlap in being obsessed with, because there's a few that I think we are equally obsessed with. So before I talk about those, a question that haunts me perpetually is, why do you think certain people have favorite foods? Like, do you think it's emotional and related to like childhood and upbringing? Is it a nutrient thing? Because if it was a nutrient thing, you wouldn't think that you would perpetually be needing that nutrient, but maybe you would. And also like food aversions and like the whole thing on like feeding kids section is amazing. But yeah, why do you think we gravitate towards like favorite foods?
Such an interesting question. I've never been asked that. Well, regarding the childhood and what we were exposed to actually in utero will have some effect on what we crave. So in that section that I talk about feeding baby or nourishing our children, I talk about, I think his name's Dr. Green, who did research on babies that were born from moms in different cultures. And if they were exposed to Indian spices or South American spices, spicy food, different food, and the children would have a predilection towards those foods because they were actually exposed to it in the cord blood. So there's early childhood exposure that absolutely does influence your palate and your taste. And then there's early exposure in infancy. So you start eating, you know, well, first of all, there's flavors that actually come through the breast milk. So when mom's diet is varied, her breast milk will have more flavonoids and polyphenols and will actually have aromatic compounds, and it will imprint on baby, and baby will crave those foods. So when, you know, that's a good thing for nursing moms to remember that the baby is starting to get influenced by what it is getting through the milk, what it's seeing, the colors, the variety, all of that will influence what baby likes. And then the first foods that a child gets will start to imprint flavor profiles on them. So it is really important that we introduce bitter flavors, sour flavors, tart, all of that, not just the sweet flavors, because our bodies will crave those flavors that we have an early relationship with. Now, most people will not go for a bitter food. Like most babies won't go for a bitter food right away. But if you keep introducing it to them, like you just let them try it over and over again, by the fifth, sixth, seventh time, they will actually start to create a desire for it. So they might have an ability to manage a more bitter greens and bitter foods. So a lot of parents make the mistake of feeding a baby, let's say pureed kale or something, and baby turns away and they're like, oh, my baby doesn't like kale. Well, Dr. Green's research shows that if you give that baby kale, a little spoonful of kale every other day for a week or two, the baby will eventually be like, ooh, yum, kale. So it's not that we're trying to force something on our children that they innately don't like. We're giving them their taste buds an opportunity to grow and change and actually then maybe desire it. Now, if a child keeps turning something away, I wouldn't say keep offering forever, but Dr. Green's research shows that most parents give up too quickly. They will give up on the second or third try and they will say, my baby doesn't like carrots. And then they will never give that kid carrots again. That kid may not have carrots until, you know, 5 years later. So I, you know, with my family, I tried to just allow food to be an exploration and keep trying things and develop your own palate. And as far as why some people are going to gravitate towards some foods and not others, I think it's really intriguing to try to understand. I don't know that I have a clear answer. I'm thinking about my own children and observing them in the younger years. I saw that they would gravitate towards fatty foods and nutrient dense foods a lot because their body's intelligence was telling them we need to grow. We need food that's going to give us a lot of bang for our buck. So the salad is not as interesting, but the meat and the cheese and the avocado, that's more interesting. The smoked salmon, very interesting. It's salty, it's high in protein and high in good fat. And I just observed in my children, wow, this is such intelligence right now. They want the calorie dense food because they need that. They need for their body to grow. And they like their fruit because it's a natural sweetener and it's going to give them energy right away. When I observe my own cravings, I notice it's usually will kind of tell me where I am in my menstrual cycle, tell me where I am with like, did I just do a big workout and now I'm craving something more calorie dense because I probably got into a bit of a calorie deficit. And so now all of a sudden I want like a burger, and where normally I'd be happy with like the salad with a little bit of tofu on it or something. So I think it's always our body in some way giving us some information about where we are and what we need. And it's an opportunity to tune in. And even if we're craving chips, we might take that information and say, okay, I am craving something salty. Probably I'm a little dehydrated and I probably am, maybe I'm a little stressed. My adrenals are wanting that extra salt. So could I do some electrolytes in my water and then have some carrots to get the crunch to try to emulate what that craving is saying that you want? And, you know, just sort of using that as information from your body.
Yeah, I loved the section on cravings and you go through all these different things and, you know, what the craving might actually be indicating. I don't have kids. I don't anticipate having kids. And still, I was like the whole section on feeding kids. I was like, this is brilliant. Like all of these different tips and tricks and things that I hadn't thought about before. Like you make the case of not, you know, dumbing down food for kids. Like they don't have to eat, you know, these really basic plain things. Like they can eat more elaborate concoctions. Is that accurate?
Yeah, they can eat what grownups eat. When someone says, what should I eat? What should I feed my kids? I say, whatever you eat. That's what kids should eat is what grownups eat. Now, of course, they might want it a little less spicy or might want it, you know, I always joke about the toddler plate where like every food is like by itself. Like you put the broccoli by itself and you put the pasta by itself and the meat by itself because for some reason they like that categorization style. But there's no reason that they can't eat the smoked salmon or olives or a richer, you know, a rich flavored food. They actually usually like it. And I think that it's mostly our training that tells us that they want the plain noodles and the chicken fingers. I don't find that kids, when they are offered a variety of food, will actually go for the plain food. Now, some will. Some children just, their body says, no, it's too much information for me. They might be sensory sensitive in general. That might be the same kids that don't want any scratchy clothing on. Sounds can be too much for them. Bright lights can be too much for them. They may get overwhelmed with a lot of flavors. And so that can be a reason why a kid might go for something very plain. But other than that, I think kids can handle some pretty complex flavors. And I like to give them the opportunity to make those decisions on their own instead of me determining what was a kid food and what was an adult food.
And also to that point, you said that by the time they were 8, they could cook a 4-course meal. What is that experience like with the kids in the kitchen? Like, did they help you with create these recipes and everything, your kids?
Yeah. So with getting kids to cook, it is a long game. It's like giving them little jobs from the age of 2 or 3. Okay, separate these into 2 piles. Here's your little tiny butter knife. You're going to cut all these strawberries in half. And you keep giving them jobs and responsibilities in the kitchen. We had this thing called the learning tower, which you could roll right up to the kitchen counter and then they would stand up and be right at your height. And so not every time I cooked, but a lot of the times when I cooked, I'd have them be part of it and give them jobs. Either they were kind of made up jobs or maybe eventually they were real jobs. And they're just so interested in it. They love the textures. They like to taste as they go. They like to get creative. Yes, it is more messy. Yes, it is less efficient, but I always considered it as their education. And eventually it became really helpful. And now our kids are 17 and 18 and they cook the most elaborate food. I mean, really, really elaborate food. I mean, beyond my skill level of cooking, and they love it. And it's a joy for them. They'll say, can we make dinner Saturday night? And they will plan it out all day. They'll shop, they'll make fresh bread, they'll make fresh hummus, they'll make, you know, Israeli salad, all this beautiful food. Because they are inspired and they were always inspired to be creative. I tried to give them this feeling of like, there's no real rules in the kitchen. Like, sure, if we're making bread, we're gonna measure out how much flour and baking soda, but like outside of baking, let's let there be no rules. Let's see what happens. And if 1 out of every 20 things we make is a fail, well, we learned along the way. And yes, they did help with the recipes. We tested every single recipe in our, you know, created and tested every recipe in our kitchen. And sometimes I would print out a recipe and leave it on the counter and they would come home after school and I'd say, okay, guys, this is your project, your after school project. And I'd say, will you make this again, but with less cinnamon and more almond flour? Let's see how it turns out. And they're always happy to make muffins and cookies and all of that. And, you know, they didn't have video and screen privileges. So might as well get them cooking and have a good time in the kitchen. And it was very empowering for them.
Hi, friends. You guys know I am obsessed with safe, effective skincare. One of my favorite skincare brands of all time, which is USDA Certified Organic, yes, actually Certified Organic, is Purity Woods. And friends, I'm going to be completely honest here. I already had a few skincare brands that I loved when I first found Purity Woods. So I was like, okay, another skincare brand. It was going to take a lot for me to actually add something new into my routine. Oh my goodness. The second I tried Purity Woods, it became a complete non-negotiable. And when I interviewed the founder, Brian Vasily, on my podcast, that's when I learned why. Brian discovered the astounding clinically studied benefits of organic maple leaf extract for the skin. Maple leaf extract contains antioxidant and hydrating properties that help soothe irritated or inflamed skin while also helping to plump, brighten, and nourish the appearance of your skin. So we're talking skin firming, anti-aging, all the things. It's sometimes even called plant-based Botox because of how effective it is. There are three of their products that I use every single day and night of my life. That would be their age-defying dream cream, which I use, yes, during the day, their age-defying night cream, which I use at night, and their hyperlift serum, which I use both morning and night. Every time I put these products on my skin, I just have this sigh of relief. They feel that good, they smell wonderful, I see the effects of my skin, and I just love them that much. And as you know, I am neurotic about having non-toxic ingredients. These products are incredible. You could eat them, but please don't eat them. And Purity Woods has an incredible offer for you guys. You can get up to 38% off at puritywoods.com/Melanie. Turn back time on the appearance of your skin with Purity Woods Age-Defying Dream Cream. Go to puritywoods.com/Melanie at checkout for up to 38% off. That's puritywoods.com/Melanie. I am obsessed with Purity Woods and I can't wait for you guys to try it as well. So like creating the recipes and everything, where do you land? Because I feel like, you know, there's all these different diets out there and all these different opinions about what we should be eating and shouldn't be eating and macronutrients and et cetera. Where do you fall on how people should know what they should actually be eating? And kind of like a tangent off question from there is, so, because I know you do make it, you know, pretty clear that processed foods, you know, like gravitating towards whole foods is, you know, pretty important. Where is the, I don't know if it's like the line, or if we're just making it ourselves, then can it still be, quote, like processed? Like if we're making our own salad dressings, we're making our own, you know, versions of baked goods, like where is the line of how whole we should be in our whole foods?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great question. I think that's important to say because some people might feel like if I start processing, have I denatured the food in some way? Really, if you're using whole foods, then you can do anything you want with them. Processed foods are foods that have been manipulated in some way. Like let's talk about the wheat germ has been removed. It has been likely bleached, ground down. It's in a flour. It's now sitting on a shelf for 6 months. It's exposed to air and light and heat, and the oils in there start to become rancid. So it's a very different food than the original grain of wheat. And we know that when we start breaking things down and extracting food, that it no longer has the same health benefits. It's no longer as vital. It doesn't have the same enzymes and bacteria and nutrient profile. And then it is also harder on our body to assimilate and manage. Now, if you get a bunch of ingredients and you make it yourself, it is not considered processed. Like you can absolutely make a dressing with your olive oil, your vinegar, a little garlic, parsley, whatever you want to put in there. And you've just combined ingredients, but it is still considered a whole food. Absolutely. You can throw a bunch of things in the blender. You can make a soup and cook it all down. It is still considered whole foods. It's just, it's not been denatured and processed in a way where some of the nutrients have been extracted and now it's more vulnerable to oxidation and damage. So there, you know, I think that there is there are some things that are kind of on their way to being processed, like sort of halfway, where you're like, like this snack item seems pretty okay because it only has five ingredients in it, but you know that it was milled and pressed together and now it's kind of starting to become denatured. Let's say, for example, like dried mango, would we consider that a processed food? Well, I wouldn't really consider that processed, or it's very minimally processed. You take the mango, they slice it up, they pull the water out, it's vacuum sealed, it's pretty much, you know, arrested in that state, and it's still going to have the nutrients that the original mango had minus the water. But if you were to take a bunch of mangoes and press it and make a juice and bottle it, now that's been more processed and the fiber's been removed. So once you start removing nutrients, you make it a little harder on your body. Now without that fiber, you drink mango juice, your blood sugar is going to spike really quickly. So I think there's always a distinction somewhere along the line. But if you buy, you know, whole ingredients and you want to do anything you want with them at home, you're still having a whole foods diet.
Amazing. And I really am. How many recipes are there? I'm blown away. I'm looking now.
There's 300.
300. It's literally everything you could ever want. So even like the burger section has five different burgers.
Oh, yes. They're so good. I love those burgers.
Do you have a favorite?
Yeah, of the burgers, I would say.
Or of everything.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, with each chapter, I probably have a couple favorites. The burgers, if you eat lamb, that lamb burger is out of this world. And the veggie, the black bean burger is also excellent. So those are my two favorite burgers. As far as favorites in the book, I would say some of my like fan favorites, like the people that, you know, tell me all the time, oh, this is my favorite. There's a couple that stand out. There's the life-changing loaf of bread, which is not my original recipe. A patient told me about it. I looked it up, found that it was like an internet sensation, and it is in the breakfast section. It's a not to miss recipe. It's just made with oats, nuts, and seeds and psyllium. And you put it all together in a silicone loaf pan, you bake it, and you have the most delicious, hearty loaf of bread that it's not really a sandwich bread, but it's a really good breakfast bread with avocado or an egg, that sort of thing. And then my soups are to die for. I love every one of those soups. I think my favorite soup is the Bubby's chicken soup. That's definitely a very popular one. And then the dressings and dips, I just think are so versatile because, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you can make your own dressing. I want to empower people to make their own dressings and their own sauces because that's what makes your food come alive. You can pour that on anything and then you have a really exciting dish. If you have, you know, your favorite creamy ginger peanut sauce or a green chimichurri, like, you know, you put that on the most boring food and it's now your favorite dish.
When you eat out, do you bring your own dressings or do you ask for like oil?
So what I do, so if I eat out, we don't eat out all that often, but we definitely eat out. If we're going to go to like an Asian, like Thai or Korean, I'll just kind of eat whatever's on the menu because I'm not going to be able to correct it very much. And I might get like some steamed veggies on the side and try to mix that in with whatever else we got that's like probably too salty and too sweet. But if I'm just going to a regular restaurant that's, you know, let's say I was wanting more like conventional food, I'm a little bit of an annoying person, I think, at the restaurant because I'll say, can I get the brown rice, but with the lentils from this? And can you just put the sauce on the side and I'll take some lemon and maybe a little olive oil? Like I kind of like make my own. Usually I'll do sauces and dressings on the side and I'll ask for some lemon because I think you put lemon on anything and it's fine. It's good enough. And I might ask for some olive oil and then I, you know, hope for the best. Basically.
That's literally what I do. I see the menu as like a list of ingredients. And then what do I want from this?
It's a list of ingredients. If they have it listed, it is available. You might have to, you know, a la carte it a little bit. And I think if you ask nicely with a smile on your face, like people are happy to help and you make it easy for them and just say, hey, could I get this just with that? And with a little lemon, I'll be so super happy. And they're like, yeah, we can do that for you. Yep. A list of ingredients.
I love it. So I think the food that you and I probably overlap on the most is I am very obsessed with ginger. like so much. I love ginger. And I actually started a new...
Did you see the centerfold, the ginger centerfold in the book?
Oh, is there a ginger? I was reading a lot of it on the Kindle.
In the pantry section, in the like spices.
I'm obsessed with ginger. And I actually started doing, since reading your book, I started doing a new habit with ginger, which is that I still use a lot of powdered ginger, but I've started like using a garlic press and like doing it fresh as well. Although I need a stronger garlic press because it's like a workout for me.
It is hard. You could also do it on a microplane and just kind of go back and forth. And my son does a ginger technique that he saw online where he cuts it horizontally and then he puts it on the side. He smashes it really hard with the side of a knife and it completely like just decimates it. And then it's all ground down.
So like with the blade of the knife or like the knife handle?
The flat part of the metal of the actual knife. Turns it on its side. I'm always amazed when he does it. He looks like a Japanese chef. But there's a real difference between fresh ginger and dry ginger. So in Chinese medicine, we utilize them differently. Dry ginger is so hot and drying that we'll use it for like a really wet cough. But if you continue to use dry ginger all the time, you can dry yourself out too much.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. But fresh ginger has more brightness and it's obviously more hydrated. I prefer it 9 out of 10 times, that fresh ginger pressed. It is so, so good.
Historically and still, I douse my food in ginger and turmeric and cilantro. I'm obsessed with cilantro. I eat it like... I know people add it as like a small, you know, garnish often, but I eat cilantro like it's spinach. I don't know if that's a problem.
It's not a problem. You know, cilantro is an absolute superfood. We know that it helps to clear heavy metals and it doesn't stress your body in, you know, like you can do some things that are chelating and can be stressful to your body. But if you're craving lots of cilantro, you probably are benefiting from it because you're so healthy and you're so tuned into what you desire that I would go with that. Like if you want to go big with cilantro, go big with cilantro. You can make pâtés with it. You can make pestos with it. I have in the recipe, one of my pestos is a cilantro based pesto. I'm absolutely on the same page with you. I try to tell people like, don't think of your cilantro, your basil, your parsley as like an afterthought. Like it can be the main attraction. You can go really big with these things.
I really do. Like I go and buy like 7, you know, bushels of it every time. Are you concerned at all? This is my like tangent question. Are you concerned about it redistributing metals rather than pulling them out?
Right. So there's always the question of if we do anything that pulls metals out, what's going to happen next?
Yeah, like where they go.
Yeah. So metals, they get stored in fat tissue and then they get pulled out by anything that's chelating. Cilantro is one of those things. Chlorella can help with that. And then it goes into your bloodstream and it has to get out. And the way that metals exit the body is through the stool and through the skin. So as long as you're moving your bowels regularly, which is daily, and sweating, then those metals are clearing. If either of those things are not happening, you do have the risk of those metals recirculating and then being deposited again.
Okay. Okay. Okay, good.
Yeah. So sweating practices are really helpful for that. And then if there's ever concern, like you're starting to feel, you know, people will feel symptoms of having a little excess metals, like brain fog, headaches, just kind of weird diffuse symptoms, you can take a binder to help draw it out, like charcoal or bentonite clay or something like that. And it will actually help bind it and move it into the stool.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. It's with the sweating piece. I do my daily sauna session every day. And it's like, it's weird to me to think there was a time I wasn't doing that regularly. Like it just feels so, I'm like, how was I not sweating all of this out every day?
Right. And did you notice that you kind of got better at sweating as you started to do it more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Which is interesting for sure.
Yeah. People will say that they're not good at sweating. And then it's actually something that your body learns to do more efficiently with more practice, with more sweating and more exercise that will stimulate that.
Yeah. So I love my sauna. I love my cold. Okay. So you've said a few different words that relate to tangents I would love to go on or rabbit holes. So one, actually just really quickly. So reading your book, I was like, oh my goodness, I'm just not jealous or envious, but I'm very appreciative of like how you raised your kids, and like being raised in this environment is just so incredible. And I'm like, all moms should read this book and implement this into their, you know, into their lives with raising their kids. And what I also loved is you have a section on, and I might be blending together different sections, but you have sections on like self-care and, you know, taking care of yourself. And for example, you point out like the benefits of, I think it's like prioritizing your time. And you mentioned that you even hired, like when your kids were younger, you hired somebody to like cook for you, like, or recipe prepare for you guys. And you point out that, you know, it may seem expensive or extraneous, but it gives you back a lot of time and it's worth, and you compare it to like the prices to going out to a restaurant, you know, and think about it that way. So one of the things I loved was you, cause you just seem like the like super mom, and you talk about the role of not losing your identity, like not having the entirety of your identity being like a mom, for example. So yeah, how do you feel about, like, I guess mothers in particular, but anybody, like where their identity lies and like maintaining and taking care of yourself so that you can take care of others. Like, how do you feel about like that, like self-care and identity?
Yeah, I have so many thoughts on that, having moved through, I guess, different identities in a way, you know, like as a daughter and as a mom, as a medical student, like all these, we wear all these different hats, and I know we all want to show up for these roles with a lot of integrity and a lot of what feels right to us, but we can also lose ourselves in that process, whether we're, you know, maybe caretaking for someone or working crazy hours at our job or working crazy hours as a parent or some combination. And so how do we maintain sense of self while we're doing the thousand things? I think this morphs over time, depending on what's available to us, how much time is available to us, and what our needs are. But I think having some regular practices that we turn to that allow us to check in. So whether it's like a walk outside or getting on the yoga mat, for me, one of the things I do is I go and I dance, like, you know, I like to dance once a week, ecstatic dance or five rhythms dance, where I just kind of go and let that be my moving meditation. It's an opportunity for me to return to myself. And some of that requires structure and strategy. And some of it requires boundaries, like telling, you know, whoever needs to hear, like, just so you know, I'm taking my walk at 3 o'clock, like mom needs her time, or I'm going to take this meeting while I go on the move, or I'm going to Wednesday night dance. Everyone knows that mom goes to dance on Wednesday nights. So it requires more than just saying, I would like to do this. It actually requires that you look at your schedule, that you schedule and prioritize time for yourself, and that you create strategies so that can happen. And there's a million ways where we can return to ourselves. We can journal, we can do breath work, like holotropic breathing, breath wave, anything that just allows us to tune in. Maybe it's spending time with friends and people that you love that can remind you of who you are, and recognizing that it's not selfish to desire to care for yourself. In fact, it's your responsibility. You get one body, you get one life, and no one says that you're supposed to give it all away. In fact, you're supposed to treat yourself so beautifully that you hopefully have that extra energy to then give to the world. But really, you have to manage yourself first. And, you know, getting to bed at a good time, eating food that makes you feel nourished and whole. And I know it's like easy for me to say now that my kids are like, you know, halfway, 1 foot out the door, and like life's pretty easy for us now. It wasn't when they were 2 and 3 years old. It really wasn't, which is why I hired someone to come once a week and help us with recipes in the kitchen. We were beyond our ability to do all the things and do them well. And so one of my strategies was, what if I have a teenager from the neighborhood come over once or twice a week and spend 4 hours and just work on making food, like just chop a bunch of veggies, make a batch of soup, make some beans and rice. Then we have food for the week that we can pull from.
Hi, friends. I am so honored that today's episode is brought to you in part by Activation Products. I am obsessed with Activation Products. I first learned about them when I had their incredible founder, Ian Clark, on the show, and he blew my mind when it came to all things supplemental oils. I know there's a lot of debate out there about seed oils, but what if there are actually certain types of seed oils that are super healthy for you? That's where Perfect Pressed Oils comes in. They're one of the main reasons I love Activation Products as a whole. Activation uses what they call their perfect press process. It's essentially an extremely gentle, careful way of extracting oils from whole seeds so you get the natural plant compounds intact without harsh chemicals or high heat that can damage them. This is the way to get the incredible health benefits locked inside these seeds in a super easy and approachable way. And you guys know I'm very, very picky about all of this. They have so many different oils. Three of my personal favorites are their amaranth oil, their milk thistle oil, and their black cumin oil. I rotate and use them depending on what I'm focusing on, whether that's overall wellness, like with their amaranth oil, which by the way is celebrated for its beauty enhancing properties and nutritional richness, their milk thistle oil, which I absolutely love for foundational liver support, and their black cumin oil, which is amazing for daily plant nourishment and something you guys have probably heard about because it is so renowned and famous for its incredible health effects. These oils are simple, they're clean, and you can truly taste the quality. I cannot recommend Activation's Perfect Pressed Oils enough, and they have an incredible discount for my audience. Just go to activationproducts.com/Avalon. That's activationproducts.com/Avalon for a discount on Activation's Perfect Pressed Oils. These are one of the most incredible ways to support and vitalize your health. Definitely check them out. That's activationproducts.com/Avalon.
And just getting creative with where you need support and implementing it instead of letting yourself really fall away. Yeah, I mean, there's so much I could say there, but it is very important to me that especially mothers feel supported in taking good care of themselves. And you don't have to do everything all the time. You can do 5 minutes on the yoga mat. It's okay to go to your yoga mat for 5 minutes and breathe and go into a child's pose and then go back to parenting or working. You know, sometimes we have to just allow it to be enough. Drinking a quick glass of water when you get some, you know, a glass of water for your kid. And weaving your self-care into your day, even 5 minutes at a time, because you're worth it.
I love that too, that it was like a teenager that came over, because now you're giving them an opportunity, you know, to have like a job. And I would have liked doing something like that. I remember I did not like babysitting. That was like not my calling. But if there had been like things like that I could do, that would have been, you know.
And it doesn't have to be perfect, right? Like, so they're going to, you know, make a mess or whatever. Fine. We're all messy around here, but at least we have another hand that's helping.
I love it. I love it. There's just so many treasures in this book. One of the sections I really loved, and then actually one of the Amazon review people mentioned it as their favorite too. So I was like, okay, this is not just me. This was such a gem to me. The role of clutter in stress. I was wondering, yeah, your thoughts. So like in your living situation, and what is the role of clutter and decluttering and letting go of things? How does that actually affect us with stress?
The reason I added this in to this section on, I think it's within the pillars about clutter, is because I noticed a rhythm in myself that every time I would set aside time to work on my book, which would sometimes be every month, sometimes would be every 3 months, I noticed a pattern in myself, which was I had to completely clean my workspaces. Oh, I have to do the laundry. Oh, I need to do this. And I thought I was procrastinating, and I was, but also there was a certain energy that I needed and mental space that I needed when I was writing. I needed for like everything to be off the plate. And I started to notice that sometimes I would write best, or actually often write best, like when I was on an airplane sitting, I had nowhere else to be. I had nothing to distract me. Or if I would take a weekend away and get a little Airbnb, you know, at a mountain or something, there was nothing else to distract me. And I started to look into, why is it that I'm so distracted by my life otherwise? And it's this sense of when you're looking around and you have constant reminders of all the things that you need to do, put away and manage, if there's piles of bills and dishes and laundry, it's this constant drain on your energy telling you, like, you know, you need to prioritize these other things. They need to be dealt with, what you're doing, which is kind of a challenge. It's, you know, the work that you're doing that is a lot of mental work. You can't quite do that yet. You need to take care of these other tasks. And so I actually got in touch with a friend of mine who, this wonderful woman, Penelope Miller, who she is an organizer. She goes into people's homes and she helps them recreate a relationship with their home by recognizing that their clutter is an energetic drain from their overall energy and their nervous system. And she taught me a lot about how, you know, the space that we're in, where our eyes go to, even like the quality of light or proximity to a window or the sounds and smells of our environment are constantly being entrained on our nervous system and we are responding in kind. So we'll start to notice those patterns in ourselves that we will want to sit next to a window and gaze outside at a beautiful vista because it really calms our nervous system. If we take our eyes and then we move it into our kitchen and our kitchen is filled with, you know, life, we can feel a little dysregulated. And so that's why I think it is important to try to create areas. It doesn't have to be every area, but some sacred areas for you where there isn't clutter, there isn't the reminder of the 10,000 things, and allow it to be sort of a gift of that space to your nervous system, because it's really, your space is a reflection of your inner state, which is what my friend Penelope Rose Miller says. And it's in constant dialogue with your nervous system. So it's like either promoting ease or adding to that sort of sense of alarm. So I think it's really worthwhile to like have an honest conversation with yourself about all the stuff that you're around.
Yeah, it resonates with me so much. I have the exact same experience as you, which is that especially if I'm like running behind with everything and I'm stressed about getting everything done, then I have to like clean everything first. And like you said, I'm like, am I procrastinating? Or yeah, I was reading that it has a lot to do with our nervous system, like basically like all this stuff that's out, and you kind of touched on this, but it signals to us like unfinished tasks. So we can't really focus if, you know, there's all this stuff that we have to be doing. So I do this little thing where I call it throw one thing away every day. And so every day I throw something or give away, or, you know, I remove something from my apartment and then I put a little sticker on a calendar to give myself a dopamine hit. Oh, another C word. So clutter. You also mentioned briefly clothing, and because this is like, friends, there's just so much like guidance and, you know, wisdom in this book that people just don't really talk about or think about. And one of the things you point out is like the importance of the clothing you wear, that you wear being comfortable. And I literally wear, so the same, I have like three copies of this one dress, like a black halter dress. And that's what I wear every single day, because unless I'm going out, then I wear like gowns and stuff. But I don't want to have to deal with making the decision of what to wear. And I want to be super comfortable. And so that's what I wear every day.
It's so wise, really. It's so wise to find something that works for you, that makes you feel like you. And then I notice I completely feel like a different person depending on what I'm wearing. If I have my work clothes on, I'm in my work mode, and then I put my cozy clothes on. And then like, if you put like really cozy clothes on and slippers, like don't think that you're going to, you know, you're not going to make a lot of progress with your clutter probably, because you're just like too cozy. So recognizing like just putting the sneakers on will allow you to move differently in your house. And, you know, that black halter that you feel cozy and you feel yourself in, and you feel like you can be productive, you can be all your people in. I think that's so wise. I love that you found your outfit.
My outfit. I often wonder, because I work from home, but I have to leave the apartment every day. So I go do cryotherapy every day. I go to Whole Foods every day. And I'm like, I wonder if these people notice that I always have the exact same thing on. And I don't even adjust for the winter. So like when it was like in the teens last week, I still wear my summer dress to Whole Foods. And people like stare at me like I'm crazy. And they're like, aren't you cold? I'm like, yes, but it's good for you. Like you don't have to be, you know, perfect ambient temperature all the time.
Right. Oh, that's great. I would love to see you in that dress.
Well, I was going to say it's pretty much, I wear it a lot on all my photos unless I'm wearing gowns. But, okay. So here's something I do clothing wise that relates to a topic that I know you're passionate about. So I don't wear bras. I do not remember last time I wore a bra. And I'm very like flat chested, so I don't really need one. But the breasts and the health of our breasts. So you have a really, you have a whole section on like the importance of like touch and massage and, you know, therapeutic touch. And in particular, like massaging our breasts. And what should we know for our breasts as far as like food, massaging? Do we need to wear bras? Like, is it okay that I don't wear a bra?
It's 100% okay to not wear a bra. Bras are meant for our physical comfort and our, you know, if we have a certain desire in the way that we want our breasts to look under clothing. But bras are not necessary at all. It is not problematic at all for the breasts, even pendulous large breasts, to be without support. That's really just a personal preference. Okay, so what should we know about the breasts? So I love talking about this. I do lectures on this. It's entitled How to Love Your Boobies. And it's always a really well-attended lecture because it's just fun to talk about this part of our body without it just being pathologized or sexualized. It tends to be one of the two. It's like either we're like looking for cancer and we're scared, or we're trying to figure out how to make our breasts look best, you know, either not clothed or clothed to attract other people. But I like to think about the whole area of the chest as it's a very important area. Metabolically, it's really important. There's a lot of lymph activity. There's glands and, you know, that's where milk is produced. There's just so much going on in this region. And I like for people to recognize that this part of the body really does want touch. Just like your neck and shoulders want touch, your whole chest and breasts want touch. And this is a great opportunity for us to get in touch with ourselves. You spoke earlier about like, what's kind of like, how can we return to ourselves? Well, breast massage is a great way to return to ourselves. We get out of the shower, put a yummy oil on, know that anything you put on your skin is going to absorb into your body. So make sure that oil is really simple and organic, like an organic almond oil, maybe with some rose essential oil added in, something delicious like that. And you just massage the whole region of the breast. I'm doing it right now. You can't see, but you can lift your arm up in the air and like massage your armpit down into the bottom of the breast, go in between them. It's not about really like squeezing like you would, you know, squeeze the neck and shoulders. It's more like long, lovely strokes. You're doing it in a fashion that feels good to you. It's not about it being a certain technique. Any movement of the breast tissue is going to increase the lymphatic flow and that return of lymph right there in the chest. And it will actually reduce density in the breast tissue. If you do it regularly, you will have less density in the breast, which is important because density in the breast can get in the way of getting a really good mammogram, or sometimes density in the breast can be painful and create pain, especially right before our menstrual cycle. So regular breast massage will reduce the lumpy, bumpy breast tissue. It will increase lymphatic drainage. There aren't great studies about this, but my guess is that it absolutely would reduce the risk of cancer because you're quite literally moving things out. You're moving toxicity out and increasing blood flow. And anytime we do that, we increase the health of the tissue. So I think all of that is really just important for our mental health, for our physical health. And then we can do other things for our breast health, like avoiding the foods that will create the density. So that's unfortunately black tea, red wine, coffee, and chocolate. It's like the four favorite things for a lot of women.
The tannins, or like, is it a compound?
Yeah, it's a lot of the tannins that do that. And they create density in the breast tissue. Now, this is, you know, that recommendation is really only applicable if you have dense breasts and you want to try to reduce that. And it wouldn't be to avoid them all the time, but maybe switch out your coffee for green tea or even better matcha, because that has breast supportive nutrients in it. Matcha is a really good superfood for the breast tissue, and coffee has that other effect of maybe increasing density. And then there's a lot of superfoods for the breast. So we know, I just mentioned matcha. We know that maca is really good for hormone balancing, for estrogen, and for the breast tissue. Shatavari is great. That's an Indian asparagus root. And it's just kind of a really neat root that you can get in a powdered form and add it to a drink. Turmeric is good for the breast tissue. All the antioxidants, all like the berries and colorful foods are going to be great for breast tissue. And lastly, y'all mentioned that flax, oh, and soy are really good for healthy breast tissue, like organic edamame, something like that. Having that, I wouldn't say like tofu necessarily because it's pretty processed, but having some organic soybeans in your diet is actually good for the breast tissue, as well as ground flax seeds. And I would say that's probably good for most people to do like a heaping tablespoon of ground flaxseed. It helps to bind the excess estrogen that comes through the gut and move it out of the body. And that's one of the pathways to getting estrogen out, which we really want to do because we don't want excess estrogen hanging around. It can make our breast tender and it gives us an increased risk of any estrogen sensitive cancers. So I think all those things together really do support overall breast health. And I just love the idea of people becoming comfortable with massaging and touching their own breast tissue.
I love this. And I really like habit stacking. So I think I might start doing this like when I'm in the sauna. Would that work?
Yes. Great idea. Yeah. So bring in an oil that you like. And just start with your armpit and move down the breast and chest and just do your whole chest. And you can do your belly too, and your get under your ribs and get into your liver and the whole abdomen, the whole torso wants touch. So you might as well, yeah, do it while you're in the sauna. It's a great idea.
Yeah. And I really appreciated the touch section. My theory here, and I had Dr. Gabor Mate on the show and he confirmed this is probably what caused this because, you know, he thinks everything is trauma, which maybe it is. I was born, like I was immediately put into one of those like ICU boxes when I was born. And I have like a mechanism. I don't like hugs, for example. I don't like people touching me. Like I can warm up to it, but I immediately have, and it's not me cognitively disliking it, but it's, there's like a wall there. So I'm really intrigued by like the therapeutic benefits of touch and how to get it, like how much do we actually need it? So I get like massages that I really like, but yeah, like touch in general, is it important for our health?
Yeah, it's actually, when I researched for this particular section on physical touch, I was surprised with what I learned, because I learned that we're really wired for touch. And it is obviously like our first instinct with a baby is to hold them and swaddle them and cover them and for that skin to skin contact. Our skin, which is, you know, largest organ of our body covering the whole thing, is somatosensory. It's our main somatosensory system. So it's constantly receiving information about where we are. Sensing the environment for cues of comfort, safety. Is it hot? Is it cold? Do I trust this person? It's like always on alert. And when we are touched by a loved one or someone we, you know, trust, our body is receiving that information as like, oh, okay, I'm safe. I'm loved for. It increases oxytocin. But we can actually give ourselves that too. So if it's startling for your nervous system to be hugged or embraced or touched by someone else, you can actually get the same benefit with your own hand on your chest. Or, you know, rubbing your neck, like those are some really sensitive areas that will respond to that type of touch. I notice myself, like I'll like self-soothe in the middle of the night and I'll just like rub my clavicle and my neck. And I'm like, oh, okay, I guess I'm like getting myself back to sleep. And we really are just wired for that touch. It's so interesting. And when we don't have touch over time, we can actually feel hunger for it. And I notice this with my patients a lot. I'll notice it with especially my older patients who are not partnered and I don't think they're getting a lot of touch in their life. And I always start my sessions on the table. I do acupuncture with a lot of my patients and I always start with my hands on their feet or at their forehead and occiput. But I always start my sessions with some touch and I'll spend 5 minutes doing like some reflexology massage. And I can kind of get a sense for people that are a little starving for touch because their body will just sort of melt into me. And and they'll make, you know, sweet little sounds like, oh, thank you. You know, like they're just, I can sense that their body is like, oh my God, I didn't know I needed this so much. And, you know, it makes me happy that I'm there doing that, but it makes me sad that they're not getting more of that in their life. And it could, you know, they could get it from a loved one, but they could get it from a pedicure or massage, or, you know, maybe someone that they could trade foot massages with, something like that. But I really think that we really do need touch. It's so powerful. And it also comes, it's like, you know, it's kind of like loaded too, because we can't just request touch from anybody. And it doesn't necessarily feel safe from anybody. But being touched in a pleasant way, it contributes to our total system rebalancing. It's like a reset.
Yes. Well, I loved that section so much. You mentioned sleep. Just actually before that, quick question about soy, because you mentioned the edamame. I feel like there are a few categories of food that are like very hotly debated, especially in the health and wellness sphere. And soy is definitely one of them. And it's weird because it's proposed as addressing or causing the same issue. So it'll be like soy causes too much estrogen, but also soy is good for estrogen. So how do you feel about soy? Is it, yeah, soy.
Soy, I think some of the reasons that soy gets a bad rap is because non-organic soy is a very unhealthy food. It is heavily, heavily sprayed. And soy is making it into so many processed foods. It's like in burgers and in weird fake meat, and it's everywhere. And it's in a form that is not good for us. And so I think soy is like being blamed, but the soybean, an organic soybean, is not really all that different than a garbanzo bean or a mung bean. It, you know, it has protein. It is, has some calcium in it actually. And what's unique about soy is it's lightly estrogenic. So it has phytoestrogens in it. Now, phytoestrogen foods are unlikely to elevate estrogen levels for someone who has high estrogen or someone who has cancer. They only lightly bind to the receptors. So when people say, oh, I have a risk of breast cancer in my family, I'm supposed to avoid soy, that is a total misunderstanding. And the reason that they think they should avoid it is because they think it adds to their estrogen load. But what it does is it lightly binds to the estrogen receptor. So technically, that means that it competes with more aggressive forms of estrogen in the body. So someone who's at risk for breast cancer technically should be eating regular soy in their diet, like a cup of edamame every couple of days, because that will compete and lightly bind to that receptor, as opposed to, because it has more estriol in it, as opposed to the estrogen that's in your body, which is estradiol, E2 predominantly, which is going to have a stronger estrogenic effect. So it's really a misunderstanding of that biochemistry when we're demonizing soy as an estrogen-rich food. It only lightly produces or binds to those receptors, meaning it will have a light estrogen response. Now, if a woman is perimenopausal or menopausal and her estrogen is going off the cliff, that light receptor bond will actually help normalize her estrogen levels and give her a little boost. But it is not, I never consider it risky in a breast cancer patient. I consider it more harmonizing. And I just don't think it needs to be demonized. Yeah, if you eat a ton of tofu all the time, it might act as a goitrogen and kind of slow down thyroid function. But eaten in small amounts, maybe as some miso or fermented as tempeh or cooked as just, you know, edamame, I think it's a fine food to have in the diet.
Awesome. Yeah, it's crazy how polarizing it can be, that food.
Yeah, because soy milk is not great probably for anybody, but a cup of edamame, I don't think it's going to hurt anyone.
Hey, friends. Did you know there is an ancient botanical that modern research shows performs on a level comparable to metformin when it comes to supporting healthy blood sugar levels? And not only that, this compound also supports the gut microbiome, healthy cholesterol levels, and even stimulates the AMPK pathway in the body to support cellular cleanup and longevity. You might have heard about AMPK. We talk about it a lot in the context of fasting, which also stimulates it. I am talking about berberine. I take berberine every single day of my life, and I see massive differences on my my CGM, my continuous glucose monitor, when I use it. I take it to support my fast and before meals to reduce blood sugar levels. It is a powerhouse of a compound. And like I said, people are prescribed the pharmaceutical metformin to control their blood sugar levels when they could be taking this completely natural compound that has been used for thousands of years in both ancient traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. I wanted to make the best berberine on the market, so that's why I created AvalonX Berberine 500. We did so much testing to find the most potent, pure, and clean form available. There's no problematic fillers, no common allergens, just pure, vegan, lab-tested berberine extracted from traditional sources. Friends, I am not kidding the difference I see on my blood sugar levels with this berberine. We're talking no post-meal spikes when I eat all that fruit and lower fasting blood sugar levels. It also reduced my HbA1c and my cholesterol levels. You can get it at avalonx.us and the coupon code IFPODCAST will get you 10% off. You can also get a one-time 20% off coupon code when you text AvalonX to 877-861-8318. That's AvalonX to 877-861-8318. And you can get a 15% off coupon code by signing up for email updates. For that, just go to avalonx.us/email list. Again, friends, this is one of the most powerful compounds you can add into your health and wellness routine. Healthy blood sugar control, even if you're not pre-diabetic or diabetic, is so important. And berberine helps support that. It is the ultimate compound for blood sugar control, cholesterol, your gut microbiome, and longevity. Get it at avalonx.us with the coupon code IFPODCAST. Sleep, the importance of sleep. One of the things I loved that you mentioned, because I definitely in my life have done a 180 on sleep. Like I went from thinking I'll sleep when I'm dead to I must get all the sleep. You point out like with naps that, you know, the most productive people take naps. Like, you know, it's a good reframe for sleep. How do you feel about the importance of sleep? And that said, I still have, and it's weird that I have had this for so long, but I still have this weird guilt, like this tinge of guilt that I feel like, oh, I need my like 9 hours or I'm going to take a nap. I don't know if that guilt's ever going to go away. And I'm like, where does this come from? So what, how do you feel about sleep and particularly like feeling guilty about sleeping?
Oh, I think that guilt comes from just really productive people thinking like they should always be producing. So it's just part of that hard wiring of like, my worth is somehow wrapped up in how much I get done in a day. I tend to be one of those people. And I have a very strict relationship personally with sleep. I will not compromise sleep for pretty much anything. Because I started to recognize how I felt with less sleep, and it wasn't okay. Like I could not show up in the way that I want to show up. I want to work hard, play hard, be really present, be there for my family. And I would say that sleep is probably my number one requirement for that. And for me, it's seven and a half hours is my like minimum. I really like 8 or more. Now, they've done studies that show that women need a little more sleep than men, 30 to 60 more minutes a night. So I like to remind people of this because some men like to brag that they, you know, do great with 6 hours and they don't understand why their wife doesn't. Well, actually, we're different and we need more sleep. So if anyone tells you how much sleep they need, they're right. If it's 10 hours, they're right. If they think they're getting away with 5, they're probably barring from Peter to pay back Paul and are going to suffer from it at some point. Sleep is such a metabolically active time. It's not just like what we do when we run out of ideas of what to do in the day. It's when our glial cells, that's the most abundant cell in the nervous system, sweeps out and detoxifies brain cells that have been, you know, that are actually no longer useful. Essential hormones are produced and regulated while we sleep. So we make growth hormone. We do a lot of repair while we sleep. So much of our endocrine function requires that we get good sleep. And one of the things that a lot of perimenopausal women will complain about is that their sleep is getting affected. And it is actually one of the reasons why they're starting to gain more weight. Because if you don't sleep enough, it is really hard to keep your weight in a healthy range. You'll have more dysregulated cortisol. It's like a long list of things get affected by not banking enough sleep. It's when we do our growth. It's when we do our repair. And so, you know, the science is clear that sleep deprivation accumulates and has significant detrimental effects. And unfortunately, we're able to mask it fairly well with caffeine and sugar and stress. And so we might not notice that we are chronically sleep deprived. We might think, okay, I get, you know, I get away with 6 hours a night, and then I drink 3 cups of coffee a day, and then I drink wine at night to settle down, and I, you know, repeat. Well, they basically are hiding the fact that their cortisol is all out of rhythm and that they're using caffeine and sugar to keep themselves going, or maybe they're, you know, even using stress to keep themselves going. And, but if they were honest with themselves, they would realize that they're actually pretty exhausted. So I, you know, 7 to 8 hours is a goal. And as far as naps go, I like to think of naps as little brain resets. And it's, you know, for me, I take a nap when I can't figure out what else to do. Like, I don't want to chart. I don't want to clean. I don't want to do anything in front of me. And then I ask myself, would you like to take a nap? And my body's usually like, yes, that's exactly what I wanted to do. And I will set an alarm for 30 minutes and I will put on meditation music. And my goal is not to fall asleep. My goal is to rest. I may or may not fall asleep, but at the end of that, I feel completely refreshed. And the science is very clear that that break, that and that amount of time, about 28 minutes, it is like an opportunity for your brain to do some clearing and to, it's not going to get you into REM sleep, but it's going to be like, it's going to be a refresh for your brain and give you like a new start. So I'm a big fan of napping, but if you nap for longer than 30, 35 minutes, you might start to get into sleep cycles, like a deeper sleep cycle, and that could mess you up a little bit. So I usually recommend the cat nap, like under 35 minutes.
So my hack for naps that I love doing is the sauna I have is the Sunlight and the Solo unit, which is, I don't know if you've seen, it's the one you lay down in. Your head is like outside of it. It's a hard shell dome. So it's not like a blanket or anything. But so I take sauna naps. So I will like take a nap in my sauna. So then it's kind of like I got a cardiovascular workout and detoxed while taking a nap. So it's multitasking. So I love that. And then that reminded me, because you're mentioning the alarm, I loved the chapter, and I mentioned this topic a little bit earlier, but you have a section on like healthy dopamine levels and supporting dopamine and all the problems about, you know, oh, like that's something I learned, that like teenagers actually like need more dopamine, for example. But I am like you, like I love encouraging dopamine drips, like healthy ways of getting dopamine throughout the day. Yeah. So what do you do with that, with like with mini drips of dopamine in a healthy way?
Yeah. So we want dopamine throughout the day because it's very motivating for us. It keeps us in the game. It keeps us sharp. It gives us the sense of pleasure. And we have unfortunately gotten entrained to desire bursts of dopamine instead of like the slow release, what you're mentioning. Dopamine is produced a variety of ways. We get dopamine from eating protein. When we have regular protein throughout the day, it stabilizes our blood sugar and it increases our dopamine. And I think that every meal and every snack should have some protein in it. So it could be nuts, it could be beans, eggs, well-sourced meats, whatever. We don't want to skip meals, because when we skip meals, our blood sugar is going to get wonky and our dopamine is going to drop. And then we could go for something that's not a great choice for us. So that's when you start reaching for the chocolate cake. We know that movement, exercise, is a great source of dopamine. So I recommend that people move throughout the day. They don't have to just do their 1 hour at the gym, but take 5 minutes to do some bodyweight squats or hang from a bar or do some pull-ups or take a walk around the block. And it's okay to space your exercise out. You can do these little exercise snacks throughout the day. It does not have to happen all at once. The research is pretty clear that you can do 3 10-minute walks, and it's the same as doing your 30-minute workout. Your 30-minute walk. So I would say spreading out movement is really helpful, or just like trying to stay in motion quite a bit throughout the day. Obviously, sleep will affect our dopamine production. So lack of sleep will disrupt dopamine levels. If you have a bad night of sleep, you usually will have reduced concentration and coordination the day after, and maybe like crave carbs, sugars. And that is largely due to a lack of dopamine. So that's like something interesting to observe in ourselves. Like if we had a bad night of sleep or not enough hours, we might wake up that morning and all of a sudden that's when we want like a bagel and cream cheese instead of our normal healthy breakfast. So that's like back to our cravings talk at the very beginning. Like your body might be telling you like, oh boy, my dopamine's a little low. Now I want sugar to overcompensate, because if you have sugar, it's going to give you a quick rise in dopamine as opposed to protein's slower progressive rise in dopamine. Studies have shown that listening to favorite music, especially instrumental, will increase dopamine levels. So that's something I encourage my kids to do. If they're studying something that they really don't want to study, I'll have them put on like binaural beats or something like really low key jazz in the background and see if it helps them. And one of my kids, that helps him tremendously. And he has found his study rhythm with music, and he knows exactly what he listens to depending on what type of homework he's doing. And it'll keep him focused and in the game. And then setting small goals, like if you can have like kind of like, you know, you're throw one thing away or give one thing away each day, like that's actually a little dopamine hit. You're like, okay, I found the thing. So if you set these small goals, like usually something that takes 3 to 7 minutes to complete, like, okay, I'm going to unload the dishwasher for 5 minutes, or I'm going to forward the laundry, like kind of like these small goals throughout the day, they give you this reward feedback. And then look, now your kitchen's cleaner because you've rewarded yourself with these little tasks. Yeah, there's just like a lot of different things. Getting sunlight, meditating, and then of course there's supplements that will help boost dopamine, like B complex and magnesium will help you keep your levels up.
Now that I think about it, that's what I do, especially to break up time of like sitting and working for extended periods of time. I break it up with little like mini cleaning tasks and such. And then I basically clean the apartment throughout the day, get little dopamine hits, break up being sedentary. Yeah, it works really well.
I do the same thing. Yeah, it's rewarding and it just allows the tasks to feel less intimidating too.
Exactly. Okay, one other last topic maybe. So this is something that definitely affects people's neurotransmitters and is heavily debated, and it's two beverages that maybe health beverages or maybe not. So coffee and wine. So what are your thoughts on coffee and wine?
Coffee and wine, right. I know. Yeah, these are two beverages that we use as medicine, right? We are utilizing these plants for their medicinal action. And this is like when people say to me like, "Oh, do you think like herbal medicine really works?" I'll say, "Have you ever had a cup of coffee?" And then they look at me, they're like, "Oh, okay, I didn't realize that was an herb I was drinking every day." All right, so we'll hit both of them separately. Coffee, friend or foe? Well, it is so individualized to the person if coffee is a match for their body or not. Now, first, actually, before I talk about the individual ways we might interact with coffee, I first want to say that coffee can be grown in a way that is not healthy for us. It could be loaded with pesticides and mold. So I'll say that anyone who does drink coffee, please drink a well-sourced coffee, fair trade, mold-free, organic coffee, because it's really important how you source your coffee, especially if you're going to have it every day. Make it really good for you. Allow it to be the superfood that it has the capacity to be. Okay. That being said, and don't drink it out of a plastic cup. Come on. Like we deserve better than that. Some people respond to coffee in a way where it has the benefit of increasing blood flow to their brain, increases nitric oxide, it increases their muscle firing capacity, their memory, cognition. And that's why we love it, because it gives us sort of a superpower. Now that superpower is limited, and then people might decide to continue to do that throughout the day. And maybe then they get to a point where they're sort of wired but tired at night, and they need that wine, that depressant to bring themselves down on the other end. And so this is an example where you're using this plant medicinally, but then it can become a problematic in your body as, you know, the dose increases. So it is very dose dependent to figure out what your specific dose is, where you are not going to increase cortisol, increase anxiety, maybe get heartburn from it or lose stools or, you know, have trouble sleeping, because all of those things are very possible with coffee. All of those things can happen to any individual, and it is dose dependent. Now, for me, I can't tolerate any coffee. I literally don't take more than a sip, because I know that too much coffee absolutely overstimulates my nervous system, overstimulates my gut, affects my sleep, and is not a friend for me. So it is not a medicine for me. It's more like a poison. But that's just because that's how my body metabolizes and interacts with it. So it is up to each individual to figure out how their body is going to interact with it and have an honest understanding of that. Now, some people recognize that they love coffee, but they're not sure how it works for them. And they maybe take it out for a little bit. And then they realize, you know what, I actually have more energy without coffee, because I'm allowing my adrenals to sort of communicate with me, like what I need throughout the day. And I'm not over sort of overriding it. And so that is what some people will recognize. Some people will recognize that they do better with green tea or yerba mate or some other caffeinated beverage. And then some people come back to it and say, you know what? Coffee is an absolute match for my body. And I say for them, great. Just use it responsibly. Have one cup, see how you do. If we're up to three or four, it's probably too much for most humans. And just recognize that that relationship and the limits of that relationship, having a real honest assessment of that. Like, I've had patients come to me that have chronic heartburn and they want to know what herbs they should take for it. And then I do a whole, you know, system review. And I said, well, you're drinking coffee every day. Do you think it could be contributing? And they're like, oh God, I hope not. And I'll say, let's take it out for 2 weeks and see what happens. And then sadly, some of them come back and say, I cannot believe this. I've been drinking something every single day that gives me heartburn. So, you know, just recognizing the power of it, both good and bad, and having an honest, you know, relationship with it. Wine is made from grapes. We love grapes, especially if they're organic. The fermentation of those grapes is going to create something that your body now has to metabolize in a very specific way. So when we drink any alcoholic beverage, our liver has to basically metabolize it and get the acetyl alcohol converted to something where it can be moved out of the body. That process does take a lot of work, and it can be, for some people, too much work and can overwhelm the liver's capacity. Now, there's a lot of genetic variance in how well we metabolize alcohol. So some people can have a drink every day and it's kind of health giving to them because it's relaxing, it's social, it's fun. They enjoy it and it lightens their life in lovely ways. It uplifts their life. But other people could have that same beverage and it can make them feel tired the next day. It can affect their sleep quality. It can make them bloated, puffy, and put a strain on their liver. So it is absolutely something that I think people should recognize their own individual response to, which might change over time, sadly. Like, you know, a lot of women will say as they enter perimenopause, I no longer can deal with alcohol. Well, their liver is overwhelmed by everything else it's up to. And yeah, it probably can't metabolize alcohol like it used to. So that's a time when maybe you decrease or stop. I don't think alcohol is good for anyone physiologically, but I know emotionally it has a lot of benefit, you know, socially it has a lot of benefit. So just having, again, that honest conversation with yourself and recognizing where it might have benefit, where that benefit runs out and it's becoming more problematic, and, you know, maybe finding some replacements that are, you know, less of a challenge for your body to manage.
I love this perspective on everything. And on the coffee front, I will have to send you, I'm actually launching a coffee this month, hopefully, but it's going to be, you know, like you said, organic, clean, all the things. And we source the beans to be super high in CGA content and then roast it to preserve that. So it's basically, you know, the highest antioxidant potential that you can get. So I will have to send you a bag once I have it.
Yeah, that's really great that you're bringing something like that to the market, because it is a medicine, and you know, it has such high antioxidants and has such good potential for people, and people already have adopted it as a medicine. So now they just need really good sources of it.
Awesome. Well, Erica, this has been absolutely amazing. Again, for listeners, I cannot recommend the Nourish Me Kitchen books, 2-volume series enough. It is a game changer for you, for, you know, the recipes, all of the guidance when it comes to health, and just, it's really a holistic approach to everything. And then, like I said, makes a very great gift as well. So you can get it on Amazon. The link for that is nourishme.com/nourishme-book, or you can just search for it on Amazon and use the coupon code MELAVALON to get 10% off. And then Erica is so kind. She also has a free PDF that you guys can get. It's 14 steps to take good care. So we will make a link for that. So if you go to melanieavalon.com/goodcare, we will have that PDF there so you can download that. So Erica, thank you so, so much for everything that you're doing. I'm, like I said, I'm just really stunned and in awe with what you're doing, and it's helping so many people. The last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I am very obsessed with the importance of gratitude, which is also something that you talk about in the book. That your acknowledgement section. I was like, I bet she's going to have a very long acknowledgement section. I was like, called it. What is something that you're grateful for?
Well, I'm so glad you're giving me the opportunity to say this, because I was just thinking, gosh, I'm so grateful for how much time and attention you spent with the material that I created and the integrity with which you have with your show, that you're really doing deep dives. You're not just like doing a cursory look, you know, have the interview and move on. Like, this is obviously very important to you. And I'm appreciative of that, because I have done podcasts and I know what it's like for folks to, you know, do the quick read and then they move on because, you know, life is busy. But I really appreciate how much time and attention that you took with my work. And I know you take that with everyone's work. And I just love that we're resonant in these ways. I always think like my books are going to resonate with people that they're in the right time and place for. And you obviously took the time to really dig in, and you highlighted some really important things that I really want to share with the world. So thank you for giving me an opportunity to share it more widely. Yeah. Thank you for your work, Melanie, really.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. It's just such a treasure and such an honor. And like I said, I'm really, really blown away. So thank you. So friends, go get it now. Get the Nourish Me Kitchen now. You will not regret it. It can, you know, really, really help your life and those around you. And hopefully we can hang out at another conference soon.
I would love to see you in a gown or your black halter anytime.
Yes, amazing. All right. Well, have a good rest of your day and we'll talk soon.
Take care. Okay. Bye, Melanie.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information and resources, you can check out my book, What, When, Wine, as well as my supplement line, Avalon X. Please visit melanieavalon.com to learn more about today's guest, and always feel free to contact me at contact@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.